Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 31, and it's the beginning of the end for the 6th Army. The Russians had launched Operation Koltso, or Ring, on the 10th of January, which was aimed at ending the saga. But the Germans were still determined to fight on, despite running out of ammunition, food, and reinforcements. Zhukov's plan was to punch a hole through the Kessel and to split the Stalingrad city area from those German units out on the steppe. While they managed to drive the Germans from the nose of the Kessel, as we heard last episode, they stalled initially in the main aim of splitting up the pocket. This sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? After all, the 6th Army was on the run eastwards towards the city, and scenes of utter chaos were reported across the steppe. Yet the Russians also found the going difficult at times, as German defences were unbroken in some sectors. Many thousands of Germans and Romanians, Italians, Hungarians, and other Axis troops fell to the Russians after the 10th of January, 25,000 in all. But the number of German prisoners taken by the Russians was actually quite small, around 7,000. The rest of the divisions managed to withdraw to the east. However, other units had disappeared. The German 297th Infantry Division, for example, which was smashed beyond regrouping. By the early hours of the 11th of January, a message came through from the German High Command, or OKH, which demonstrated only too clearly how ignorant they were of conditions in the pocket.
Every possible step would be taken to prevent Potomac from falling into Russian hands.
On January 12th, a single Russian T-34 tank had somehow pierced the Potomac airfield defences and was ambling about around the runway, firing at will at medical tents and aircraft and men who were running in all directions. Before the Germans could recover, the mystery tank disappeared into the morning mist. The airfield had no chance of fighting off a single tank. As soon as the Russians gathered their forces once more to launch a proper assault, it was doomed. At 0940 on the same day, Army Group Radio reported that the enemy had broken through on a wide portion of the line. That night at 7 p.m, 6th Army reported to Manstein that
deep penetration east of Zabenko more than 6 kilometers wide. Our own losses were considerable. Resistance of the troops is diminishing quickly because of insufficient ammunition, extreme frost, and a lack of coverage against heaviest enemy fire.
Missing from these reports were the number of desertions. German soldiers were running over to the other side in large numbers. Many officers in the field had now lost their will to lead, and men had placed blankets over their heads as they slept at sentry posts. Worse, the mighty Wehrmacht had no tanks to fight off the T-34s. It was also at this point where British journalist Anthony Wirth was allowed to travel to the south of the Kessel, where he joined the 2nd Guards commander Rodion Yakovlevich Malinovsky, along with a few other Allied newsmen. Malinovsky said for the first time the Germans were showing signs of bewilderment, trying to fill gaps, throwing troops around from one place to another, panicking. Wirth asked him about the fact that the drive to overcome the Kessel had not been completed, and Malinovsky simply sneered and said,
"Stalingrad is an armed prisoner camp, and its position is hopeless."
Still, General Paulus was trying to do what Hitler had ordered, so on the 12th he dispatched his most trusted generals to seek help. General Wolfgang Pickett, who was the leader of the 9th Flak Division, took off from Potomac in a raging snowstorm to set off for Novocherkassk, where Manstein waited. They were supposed to plan some sort of defensive perimeter to protect the last big airfield. But his plane couldn't land at Novocherkassk. The visibility was just too bad. All avenues were leading to dead ends. Inside the shrinking Kessel and on the road between Karpovka and Potomac, German trucks were slowly moving wounded around once they'd found the all-important fuel. When reports were shouted that Russian tanks had been spotted, all hell broke loose. Trucks literally ran over the walking wounded in the driver's panic to escape. I think when we understand what fighting in hell would be like, the final days of Stalingrad must come to mind. On January 13th, the strangely disconnected chatter at Gumrak Message Center, where Paulus was based, kept up a steady stream of life and death information relayed to Army Group Don, based in Novocherkassk. As William Craig says in his great work, Enemy at the Gates, these were the recordings of the fading pulse of the 6th Army.
Herr General Paulus gave permission to Oberleutnant George Raymond, Regiment 549, to marry Miss Lena Hoswald Neustadt. Please forward.
That, of course, was a proxy marriage. She was far away. The officer knew the war and his end was near.
And proposal of decoration, General Pfeiffer sent Oberleutnant Boris received German Cross, gold.
Then,
dead in action, according to present information, Junska, Hegemann, Holzmann, Krautflich, Hulsmann, Rothmann, Hachmann. Losses of officers and troops not accountable at present, but very high.
And then later,
ammunition almost exhausted. For the assistance of the completely worn-out troops, no reserves available in terms of men, tanks, anti-tank, and heavy weapons.
Russian fighters now ruled the skies over Stalingrad. On the ground, controllers at Potomnik had managed to clear the runways for landings, but still the crazy approach, the lawlessness persisted. As the Heinkels and Junkers landed under gunfire, doctors and pilots were forced to stand in the doorways with drawn pistols, while casualties that had formal letters were allowed on board. The crippled soldiers would hobble in a rush towards these aircraft, a miserable group of dying men. Then, on the afternoon of the 13th of January 1943, a special courier left Potomnik with Paulus's war diary of the 6th Army under his arm. Remember, last episode, we left off where Hitler was about to meet this man, Captain Winrich Bär, or Teddy Bär, as he was known, and Hitler was waiting for him back in Rustenburg. It had been Manstein's idea to send someone to explain the desperate plight of the 6th Army so that Hitler would be convinced to allow them to either surrender or break out in a final, almost suicidal rush. At 9 p.m. on February 15th, Bär was finally ushered into Hitler's chamber in the conference room where the Führer would eventually survive a briefcase bomb. Bär was nervous. There were Generals Jodl and Schmundt, Marshal Keitel and General Heusinger, all household names. Martin Bormann was also present, staring malevolently at the young captain. Hitler was charming. He was laying on his special charisma just for this event. Bär was told to present his report, which he did bluntly. Morale had broken down, he said. Officer leadership had collapsed. Men were dying of starvation and blowing up their own guns when they ran out of ammunition. More than 200,000 men were dying of neglect. Hitler told Bär that another expedition, his fictitious French Panzer Corps, were at that moment preparing to come to the aid of their comrades in Stalingrad. Then Hitler turned to the starvation and ammunition issue. He was puzzled, having received reports from Göring that the Luftwaffe was sending enough sorties to save the 6th Army. As Marshal Keitel stood behind Hitler, waving his finger furiously at Captain Bär, the young man refused to be intimidated and explained how the planes had never arrived. The weather was just too bad, and they were being shot down. Worse, many of the parachute drops actually ended up behind Russian lines. Desperate times call for desperate measures. Bär went for broke, and then said bluntly that,
"It is of paramount importance that 6th Army should know the quantities of supplies that will be flown into the fortress. It is too late for long-term planning. 6th Army is at the end of its resources and demands a clear decision as to whether or not it may count on assistance and support within the next 48 hours.
That was a shocking impertinence, but understandable. Hitler stared at him. His generals and aides were stunned into silence. There it was, the truth. Keitel's face turned cherry red. He was apoplectic. Then Hitler sighed deeply and shrugged, smiled at Bär, and told him the matter would be immediately discussed and he could go. Bär saluted and left the room. It was a supreme irony that almost at the same time, 1,300 miles eastwards, the Russians had arrived at Potomnik airfield in large numbers. The T-34 tanks were within a quarter mile of the runway, and the German air traffic controllers were now waving away the few transport planes rumbling overhead. 6 Messerschmitt 109s roared off the strip to take refuge at the smaller Gumrak airport to the east. It was only a few miles away, but it remained a haven for the moment. 5 of the fighters found the runway too short and overshot, crashing. The pilot of the 6th Messerschmitt wisely decided to turn westwards and managed to make it to Schachty airfield, way beyond the Kessel. He then reported that Potomnik was no longer under German control. Gumrak was the last functioning runway, as unsuitable as it was. And Army Group Don received another spasmodic update from the 6th Army HQ, which now read,
"Supply situation catastrophic. In some places, troops cannot bring supplies to the front due to lack of fuel."
And now Field Marshal Manstein himself was under direct attack and had been forced to move his headquarters 50 miles west of Novocherkassk to a town called Taganrog. He monitored the situation along the Upper Don River, where fresh Russian armies had driven through his troops along a 200-mile front. This was another attack aimed at a few Italian divisions which hadn't been engaged yet, along with the entire 2nd Hungarian Army. They were quickly overwhelmed in this new attack, starting around the 15th January. Manstein's left flank was in tatters. His other big problem was the 250,000 Germans in the Caucasus rushing towards Rostov. Manstein and his various groups, he named Stahel, Fretapiko, Mith, and Hollit, had been crisscrossing the south, side-slipping westwards in order to slow the Russian attack on Rostov, close to the Crimean Peninsula. The Russian juggernaut was approaching southwards from the Don as the German southern army's bolt hole began to close. For the Russians, it was a much happier time. The Soviet flag once again flew triumphantly from the summit of the Mamayev Kurgan in Stalingrad, that accursed hill where thousands of Germans and Russians had died. The Russians had also retaken the symbolic Red October factory. Colonel Nikolai Batyuk's 284th Division had hung onto the northeastern slope of the Kurgan throughout most of the battle. Now Batyuk led his men back to the summit. He was especially loved within the army. A tough, no-nonsense commander, he demanded much from his men and even more from himself. Our soldiers nicknamed him Bulletproof Batyuk because he seemed genuinely impervious to danger, said one soldier later. Meanwhile, General Erhard Milch of the Luftwaffe had made it to Manstein's Tachenroch quarters, and he wasn't alone. He had brought over 100 supply planes from all over Europe and rushed them into a shuttle service to the Kessel. Milch was relying on those running the airfield at Gumrak to ensure things were organized on the ground, and of course they weren't. Gumrak was not set up as a major transport airfield like Potomnik, and it had become a magnet for retreating Germans set on escaping the hellhole of the steppe. Like Potomnik, it had become a charnel house, a place where the dead and dying gathered. Corpses littered the roads and fields around the runways, black patches in the white snow. This is where extraordinary men and women survive or die trying. Many others had already given up. Dozens of men would just sit down, fall asleep, and die of starvation and hypothermia, their bodies littering the steppe like forlorn human abbreviations in the Stalingrad story. As I know from my own combat experience, men have their own breaking points, and those who fought understand this. There is no judgment, and often there's no warning. So on January 18th, only days after the fall of Potomnik, Gumrak was crammed with thousands of wounded, and doctors were working 18-hour shifts treating patients who were on cots, blankets, the floor, some lying in the snow outside. It's reported that thousands died in these days waiting outside, mostly freezing to death overnight and within yards of operating tables. General Friedrich Paulus was messaging Manstein constantly, suggesting flights to Gumrak were required now that Potomnik had fallen. He was wrong, and the Luftwaffe rejected his claims, declaring the field almost totally unfit for use. Deliveries at this field were unlikely, they said, unless it was cleaned up. There were about a dozen hulks of planes on the threshold, burnt out, and pilots landing the Junkers had to miss the blackened fuselages. There was also almost total operational breakdown at Gumrak. The ground crew were no longer cohesive, and lawlessness characterized the situation. Luftwaffe officer Major Thiel decided in a moment of courage or foolishness to check Gumrak out for himself, and he managed to land there on January 19th. He counted the wrecks on the threshold, 13, he said later, and saw the bomb craters on the landing strip, as well as the newly fallen snow, which no one had bothered to remove. Landing here would be worse than Russian roulette for even the most skilled pilots. Then Thiel descended into the cramped and brightly lit command bunker at Gumrak, where a seething General Paulus was waiting for him. Joining Paulus was the arch-Nazi and his chief of staff, Schmidt, along with a few other aides. They then used Thiel as their emotional punch bag.
"If your aircraft cannot land, my army is doomed," screamed Paulus.
It was to be a bitter, bitter briefing that followed. Thiel was the embodiment of the failure of the Luftwaffe, and to say that he was startled by this outburst would be an understatement.
"Every machine that does so can save the lives of 1,000 men. An airdrop is no use at all. Many of the canisters are never found because the men are too weak to look for them. It is 4 days since they have had anything to eat. The last horses have been eaten up.
Teal was mute. What was he to say? Paulus was just getting started.
What should I, as commander-in-chief of an army, say when a simple soldier comes up to me and begs, Herr General Oberst, can you spare me one piece of bread?
However, Paulus was suffering from many things right now, and one was an inability to be personally accountable. In November 1942, both von Richthofen and the 2IC of the Luftwaffe, General Fiebig, had warned him in no uncertain terms that the Air Force could not hope to supply him with over 350 tons a day, let alone the 500 tons a day he really needed. But Paulus preferred to believe Goering and Hitler, none of whom had seen any of the local situation. He'd chosen to believe the demigods instead of the pragmatists. And this has led history to judge him as a weak man, lost in a haze of dreams of power, his maps, his gramophones, his cigarettes, his cognac, his wine, disassociated from reality, clinging on to hope like an adolescent. Still, Paulus continued,
why on earth did the Luftwaffe promise to keep us supplied? Who is responsible for declaring that it was possible?
He, of course, knew it was Goering and the little corporal Hitler.
I could have broken out when I was strong enough to do so. Now it is too late. The Führer gave me his firm assurance that he and the whole German people felt responsible for this army, and now the annals of German arms are besmirched by this fearful tragedy just because the Luftwaffe let us down.
Thiel tried to speak, but Paulus was going at full throttle.
We already speak from a different world than yours, for you are talking to dead men. From now on, our only existence will be in the history books.
And history will record that night. As Major Thiel returned to his Heinkel, there was further proof that Gumruck was not efficiently managed, for no one had bothered to unload the ton and a half of supplies he'd flown in. It was 9 hours and he'd been on the ground. Nothing had been moved. Thiel flew out of the Kessel and reported his conviction that the Sixth Army was beyond redemption. It was doomed. Hitler appeared to ignore the message. Meanwhile, at Gumruck, the outgoing radio messaging continued listing the brave and the cowardly.
Proposal of Knight's Cross, Oberstleutnant Spangenberg. Spangenberg held on own initiative from 10 to 15 January the flank of the 76th Infantry Division against the great enemy attack at Baburken.
Then, of course, there were others like,
Oberleutnant Billet is missing in action.
And then later,
Oberleutnant Billet left without permission by air. Request court-martialing procedures.
Other Germans were shooting themselves in an effort to be airlifted out. Whereas most of those who shot themselves in their legs and arms would be outed by the powder burns, many took the much more extreme route of shooting themselves in their own stomachs or chests. Doctors who saw the powder burns could not believe the men would inflict so grievous a wound on themselves there, so these offenders were unpunished and flew from Gumruck to hospital beds in the west, and then a hero's welcome back home. And now we halt. Next week, we hear how Paulus flees Gumruck for a dingy Stalingrad cellar just before the Russians overrun the last German airfield. Thanks to all those sending messages and notes. Remember, please rate the podcast on iTunes, and you can contact me through the website abwarpodcast.com or on Twitter @DesLatham. Until next, goodbye.